Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, sometimes on American Variety, we've had a theme that I call Dog Days, which are shows in which we look at some aspect of dog behavior or living with dogs, and that's something that interests a pretty good percentage of the population of people out there listening, and it's something that has many different ramifications to it. So today we're going to talk with Dr. Brian Hare, who's a professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University, and is founder of something there called the Duke Canine Cognition Center. He's the author, with his wife Vanessa Woods, also at Duke, of a best-selling book called The Genius of Dogs. And they also operate a website called Dognition, which is at dognition.com. And that's a scientific research project, kind of a citizen science project in a way, that helps owners identify the areas of intelligence and different kinds of personality characteristics in their dogs and produces a profile of your dog. But it also is a way for them to conduct research with tens of thousands of people rather than hundreds of people and hundreds of dogs and tens of thousands of dogs. So it's kind of a two-way street between research and then giving its users, you out there, interesting information about your dog. So we're going to focus in this show on the book and on the research on which the book is based. The book, again, is The Genius of Dogs, and the author is Brian Hare, H-A-R-E, and Vanessa Woods. They are co-authors of the book. So I would say that in recent decades, dogs have steadily moved into a more and more central role in our lives. They're no longer work animals, as they once were for centuries, but they're now family members, and in many cases, even surrogate children or even surrogate spouses, I think, for some people. And dogs have never had it so good in their history as a species. I mean, people are taking care of them in ways that children didn't used to be taken care of, and spending money, you know, a lot of disposable income and even maybe not disposable income sometimes on making their dogs happy and comfortable and healthy. People are also interested in how smart their dogs are compared to other breeds or to dogs of the same breed even. And they're interested in improving their relationship with their dogs through training. And shows like Cesar Millan's, I think he's still on TV, The Dog Whisperer, maybe on Nat Geo channel now, but have been among the most popular shows on TV in recent years. So we're going to spend some time today talking about The Genius of Dogs. Welcome, Brian Hare.
Hey, it's fun to be with you, Court.
Nice to have you on. First, tell us about your research at the Duke Canine Cognition Center. So just briefly, what do you do there?
So we're really lucky. We have a lot of people bring in their dogs, and we play games with their dogs and look at the choices they make, and then we can make conclusions about how their dogs think. So basically, the way that psychology has been studying people for a long time, we're studying dogs the same way.
Well, that sounds interesting, and I'm sure a lot of what you're doing is pretty new there, because I think dog research itself is pretty new, but we'll talk about that later in the show. But first, let's talk about your book, again called The Genius of Dogs. It came out in February 2013, and I've read, you know, about two-thirds of it at this point. It's very accessible, very readable, and full of interesting anecdotes and stories about where you went around the world. I mean, you're a very adventurous guy. You know, young scientist, you're like an explorer in a way. So it's a distillation of research findings on dog cognition from around the world and over time, because there hasn't been a whole lot of it. So you've had to reach back, you know, into the last century to find some studies on dogs that were kind of groundbreaking at the time and not even paid attention to that much by the scientific establishment. You've done a lot of research yourself, and so we'll talk about some of that. But, you know, what I want to do is maybe I'll try to summarize the main premise, and you can tell me if I'm off. I think that scientists had always speculated, and never proven really, but assumed that dogs were domesticated from wolves by selective breeding by people. In other words, that they were selectively chosen among the wolf population for various capabilities. And then, you know, as they hung around human camps or whatever in the early days of human civilization, slowly they became more and more aligned with what we needed them to be, and therefore became kind of evolved into the dogs we know today. But the premise of your research and your book is that really the first part of that, at least, was natural selection by the wolves themselves. In particular, some wolves were more friendly than others and therefore would come closer to the human encampments and would eat garbage, you know, cast off bones and rotten meat and what have you, outside the little human settlements. And therefore, their litters were healthier and had a higher survival rate because they were better fed. And those wolves who were friendlier were tolerated better by the humans. Those that were aggressive and came to scavenge or steal from the human food supply or around the camp basically were killed because they were aggressive. So the survival rate of the dogs that were friendlier was better, and they became, over time, in a fairly short period of time in terms of evolution, became a different kind of wolf. So your premise is that friendliness led the wolves to self-select, or some subset of wolves, to self-select to become more like the dogs we know today. And then at a certain point, the humans picked up that process and then began the selective breeding of those friendlier dogs. And kind of another core of your premise is that the friendliness gene in wolves causes, kind of accidentally, a couple of different things. Causes the dog to relate more closely to human needs and preferences and wishes, and also changes them physically in unusual ways, makes their color more blotchy, and their tails get curly, and their ears get floppy, and their teeth get shorter, and they become more and more like the dogs we know today through having that friendliness gene, which is an odd concept. And that's kind of the research breakthrough that you've made through your travels and studies and experimentation. So is that more or less close?
Court, you did a great job. That really is sort of a nice summary in terms of thinking about the question of where dogs come from, which is not an easy problem. At first, it seems obvious that dogs were created by man. But when you discover that we now know that dogs are at least 15,000 years old, if not 40, you instantly are faced with a problem with that idea. If man created dogs, that means man created dogs when we didn't have agriculture and we didn't have industrialization. And we lived as hunter-gatherers, and there's still hunter-gatherers today. And what we know that hunter-gatherers do is they spend a lot of time foraging. They're running around trying to kill animals to bring back and share with everybody, or they are trying to gather foodstuff from plants and bring it back and share it with everybody. And they leave their kids at home while they're off doing this. So for man to create dog, that means that 15,000 years ago, as hunter-gatherers, people went out and got wolves and left them at home with their children and then brought enough food home to them to feed them. That just doesn't seem very tenable. And I think it's then the challenge to understand how an animal that actually was the main competitor of humans 15,000 years ago and must have been incredibly annoying as you're out hunting to deal with wolves, which were really the only predator that was left in Europe and Asia after humans came out of Africa, how in the world did wolves manage to evolve into dogs and become our best friends? So that's the big question. And then you did a really nice job summarizing sort of the idea that basically wolves domesticated themselves because it was to their advantage.
Yeah, so your kind of epiphany was that there was a logical gap in the traditional explanation of how wolves became dogs, because humans had no opportunity or incentive during that time period when that transition would have occurred to actually force that transition to occur. So you kind of went at it another way, looking through, I think, an experience you had with your own dog and talking with some of your professors, the idea that the wolves themselves may have begun that selection process. So that was fascinating in your book. You went to Russia. You went to a place where there are dogs from Papua New Guinea that are a very unusual kind of dog. You sought out researchers and populations of dogs where some of this research had been done kind of under the table in a way, and particularly in Russia. There was a man who was a genius at dog genetics and behavior that was doing it under threat of death for decades and managed to evade the Stalinist authorities that were ideologically opposed to what he was doing and somehow survived and did his work. So describe just a little bit about that kind of adventure aspect of finding out what you found out that led you to your conclusions.
Well, right. So I went to Siberia to study these foxes that you speak of, Court, that were experimentally domesticated over a 50-year period. And Dmitry Belayev is the scientist who started the experiment, and his hope was to just understand how does domestication happen. What he did that was so genius was he had an experimental and a control line, and the only difference between how he maintained those two populations of actually, he used foxes, not dogs. Mm-hmm. But the only thing that he did difference between the two populations of foxes was he bred the experimental line to be friendly towards people. And that's all he did for 50 years, and they're still doing it today. At 7 months old, the foxes that approach and are friendly and excited to interact with humans and don't run away and don't try to bite, they breed those individuals together into the next generation. And after only about 15, 20 generations, they had a line of foxes that had curly tails and floppy ears and pobble coats and whine and bark when you come near, and they want to jump in your arms and hug. And the control line was still like regular old foxes. So just by selecting for friendliness, he was able to show that you get most of the characteristics that we think of when we think of domesticated animals.
And so I guess part of what you had to prove was that with the friendlier experimental population, it wasn't just that they were around humans more and that therefore kind of trained them to be more friendly. They were not around humans any more than the control population, which remained wild. And so the friendliness gene was what made them friendly, not contact with humans, right?
That's right. So there's the difference, the distinction between taming an animal and domesticating an animal. And taming is when you take a wild animal and you raise it to be socialized with people so that they're not afraid of people, in the same way that if you took an adult wild animal and tried to have it be with people, an adult wild animal would be terrified. Whereas if you have a baby wild animal and it's tame, it's not necessarily going to be terrified. But at the same time, that wild animal that you've tamed still has all the biology that would lead to aggression towards people or fear towards people in certain situations that in many cases are totally unpredictable. So for instance, having a pet wolf is a very bad idea, even if you raise it from a puppy, because even though it's a tame wolf, it still will lose its temper totally unpredictably and attack you, because its fear, its flight or fight system, is very, very different than that of a dog that through domestication has actually totally been altered such that it doesn't have the flight or fight system that would lead it to be super aggressive in unpredictable contexts relative to what you'd see with a wolf. So taming an animal, domesticating an animal are totally different. Taming is when you rear them in a different way. Domestication requires actual genetic change where the biology of the animal is such after an evolutionary process that it's no longer aggressive and it's actually friendly to people due to its biology, not because of some experience during its life.
Yeah, it's interesting. So the tame animal has like a thin veneer of civilization on top of the wild animal, but the domesticated animal, the wild animal is either much further down inside the dog or it's not present at all, maybe.
That's exactly right.
How did you, I mean, throughout your book, and even in the title of your book, you use the term the genius of dogs. How did you arrive at the concept of genius? Because, you know, at first take, I took that to mean like the IQ of dogs. But in your book, you're not talking just about individual dogs or even certain breeds, but all dogs as having genius. So, you know, off the top, it seems like a bit of an overstatement. Like maybe I would think more of, you know, capabilities of dogs or something like that. But how do you use the term genius in your book and in your thinking?
Well, I think the first thing to understand is that studying animals to understand humans reveals a lot about ourselves. And the thing that we've learned by studying animals is there's lots of different types of intelligence. And we know this intuitively. We know that when we were in school, some people were really good at English, some people were really good at math, some people were amazing athletes, some people were amazing when it came to the arts.
Right.
And being good at one of those things didn't predict being good at the other things.
Mm-hmm.
There are different types of intelligence, and they're not always related to one another. And we see that absolutely in a very clear and robust way when we look at animals. And dogs are no exception. So what the genius of dogs is all about, and why we would call the book that, is because we were able scientifically to show where dogs have a special intelligence that seems to allow them to live with us and be such a successful species that their close relative, the wolf, doesn't seem to have, and even our own close relative, the chimpanzee, doesn't have.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we think about genius when we're thinking about animals. It's not that dogs are going to write Shakespearean sonnets or fly to the moon. But when you think about what they've done, it is absolutely remarkable because they are truly the most successful mammal on the planet, probably with the exception of humans, in the sense that if you realize that they are almost genetically identical to wolves. And wolves are absolutely reviled by humans, sadly, and yet now we have something that's almost genetically identical to a wolf, in many cases living in our beds, traveling all over the world with us, and, you know, has a huge population relative to all other mammals. Meanwhile, wolves are almost extinct, or are extinct in almost all of its historical range. So what an amazing success story for a species to have managed to pull this trick off on humans. And so the question is, how do they do that? And whatever it is that allowed them to do that, to be so successful, that's their genius.
Yeah, so you're talking about a genius of adaptability that's enabled them to become as successful as a species as they are. Like the human population, through adaptability, became dominant over all the other primates and so on, and so maybe they're parallel to us in that way. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Brian Hare, a professor at Duke University who studies dog cognition and dog behavior and all the aspects of that. You know, again, what you're describing here, Brian, is a view of dog intelligence that's much broader and more three-dimensional than the limited view of that I think has prevailed in the past of how well they perform certain tasks. You know, the simple list of dog intelligence has always got the border collie at the top, for example, because they will run circles and squares and rectangles around anything that you want them to herd, and they're very responsive to humans, right? But you're talking about a whole different view of dog genius, right? So I would ask, since very few working dogs today actually do work, are dog breeds losing their distinctive characteristics that differentiated one type of working dog, you know, a water retriever in the past from a sheep herder, for example? And are there some characteristics that are more durable that stay on through the domestication and living in people's beds and couches process?
Well, this is one of the questions we try to tackle in the book. And the key thing to understand about the book is we only address these questions from a scientific perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So we relied completely and solely on the scientific literature. And the question was, what does the scientific literature have to say about questions like that?
Okay.
And the answer is not much, because it's a really, really hard question to ask. So in general, what the few studies where people have tried to examine just even the question, are there breed differences in psychology? Believe it or not, most of the measures we have, dogs that you'd think would be just crazy different based on their breed is not predicting that much. There is so much variability within a breed that breed as a category is not particularly predictive.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have a border collie and a chihuahua that are actually more similar psychologically than two other border collies and chihuahuas are. So it's not that breed, at least as we are able to measure it now, is particularly predictive.
But are dog breeds losing what were their distinctive characteristics over time? Are they getting softer and lazier? I mean, or do they still retain those no matter what, even though they're so domesticated?
I can't tell you.
Okay, fair enough.
And that's the important thing. That's the difference between, you know, in my opinion, an expert and a scientist.
Yeah, right, gotcha.
I have to tell you that I don't know. If there's not anything in the scientific literature that I can base it on, if there's not a paper that I could think of in my head and give you the citation, so then you could go and tell me that I interpreted it incorrectly,
mm-hmm.
or somebody could say, you know, hey, we need to know more there, then I can't give you an answer. Otherwise, I'm just giving you an opinion as an expert, and, you know,
sure.
My expertise isn't that much greater than yours.
Sure, I understand. A fair answer. Well, you know, as I wouldn't call myself an expert, but as a longtime observer, there's something I use as kind of a test of intelligence, and it's very narrow, and it's a simple, specific test, but over time I've noticed it. When you walk a dog on a leash, the thing that's very hard for a dog is when they go around the other side of a pole from you, whether it's a light pole or a mailbox pole or whatever it may be, and so they suddenly find the pole is in between you and the leash, and they continue on, they start to be forced to wrap inward toward you. It's very hard for most dogs to figure out that to get back to your side, they have to go away from you and back around the pole and come to you again, because their instinct is to come toward you. And the harder the thing behind them is pulling, the more they want to come to you. So they get all wrapped around trying to figure that out. Some dogs can figure that problem out after a little while, and some dogs never get it. So that to me seems like one kind of test of a certain kind of, oh, I don't know, spatial sense intelligence or something. But have you ever noticed that yourself or looked at it at all?
That's really interesting, because we actually have a whole section in the book where we talk about that. I think it's in the end where you haven't gotten to yet.
Oh, okay.
But it's actually well established now that dogs have, it's not that, you know, basically science isn't just discovering where dogs are doing remarkable things and being genius. We're also discovering where they're can be kind of vapid. And this is one of the areas where dogs really struggle, and that's in understanding the physical properties of the world. And you're describing a case that would require the understanding of connectivity, that when two objects are attached to one another, mm-hmm. that they actually act together. And that is a principle that is very difficult for dogs to understand. They can slowly learn how to respond in that situation. At least some dogs can, where, you know, I should walk on the same side as my owner to get around this pole. But they have to learn that really slowly, and they don't understand the reason why they have to do that is because of connectivity. And therefore, because they don't understand the reason, it's very hard for them to then solve a new problem that requires the exact same understanding that they've never seen before. They'd have to really slowly learn again if there was another connectivity problem. They can't just generalize what they've learned before. So that's been one of the big discoveries. It's not just that dogs are genius always. It's actually also where they struggle to solve problems and then understanding why that is.
Well, I'm going to give you another anecdote. This is my chance to tell dog stories here, I guess. But anyway, we used to live in a wide body of water called the Indian River in Florida, on the east coast of Florida. And I had a dog who our vet once described as very unusually cerebral. And he was a very smart dog. He was very alert. I think he resented being a dog. He really knew he wasn't a human, but he thought he should be, right? So so one thing he would do is I had my office in the back of the house, and he would go out on the dock. I would go out and set up a fishing pole with a fingerling mullet as bait at the end and throw it out. And I was fishing for a certain thing called a channel catfish, a gaff topsail catfish, a big edible catfish that's kind of a game fish, but they fed on the bottom like catfish do. So I would put this out there with a weight and put the pole in a holder on the end of the dock, and the dog, Rudy, would sit out there with it, and I would go back in my office and leave the door open, and I'd go back to work. And after half an hour or an hour or however long it took, when the pole started to buck in the holder, Rudy knew that there was a fish on the end, and he would turn and bark, because I couldn't hear or see that. It would be 75 yards away, let's say. He would turn and bark, 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 and I'd come running out, and he'd be all excited, dancing around, and I would set the hook and bring in the fish. And he was so excited because we together caught the fish, and he loved to see the fish when they came out of the water. He was fascinated with that. But so this was his reward, was to see the fish, and then if I'd clean it, I'd give him a little bit of it to eat or whatever. But he was totally attuned to that task, and it's fairly complicated to understand. When the pole starts to move, that means there's a fish about to come aboard. And so he got that totally and would communicate to me when it was happening. What do you think of that?
That's really cool. I mean, you know, I love hearing stories like that because, you know, the way that science works and the hope of, you know, what people do when they are trying to study psychology is that whatever they're trying to study is based on a really good observation or a good set of observations. Mm. Because if you sit around and think about and just pretend or imagine what animals do, or you imagine how they think, that's never going to lead to findings that are relevant to the real world. And the best way, of course, is to make lots of observations and see what animals are doing naturally, and then ask questions about that. Well, you know, what did your dog really understand about the fish? I mean, maybe your dog did understand connectivity. Maybe he was really unusual in that sense. Maybe your dog actually didn't understand that there was a fish, but barked because, you know, it made an exciting motion and an exciting noise, and then that made him aroused, and then he barked.
Then
you happened to come and take the fish. I don't believe that.
No, neither do I, because he saw me catch fish with that pole many times, so he knew that the pole meant it was something, a tool to bring fish in with, and he knew that when I put it there, he knew what it would happen was when it started to move a lot, that meant there was a fish.
I don't believe that the dog didn't understand it, but this is the key difference between science and not science, which is you have to come up with a way to falsify the thing that you really believe.
Hmm.
And if you can be totally objective and you say, look, the alternative explanation is the dog just was aroused by the
rattling of the
by the motion and started to bark. Mm-hmm. And then what you do as a scientist is you come up with some experiment and you'd say, okay, well, if it is just the motion, then not, if a fish doesn't come up afterwards, the dog still barks. And then you do the experiment and it ends up the dog doesn't bark unless there's a fish. And so therefore you know that it must be the fish. That's the exciting thing about science is it just pushes your really strong belief from just a belief to now a fact.
Yeah, I guess I'd have had to set the same pole up in the front yard and have someone out of sight at the end of the line start pulling on the line to have the pole rattle in the holder in the front yard, which had nothing to do with the water and therefore nothing to do with fish, and see if he just looked quizzical, like, what's that? You know. And,
exactly. Yeah, and that's the key thing about science is you have to be ready to be wrong, and you have to be potentially as excited to find out that you were wrong as that you were right. And so it's really cool if you find out your dog was really, you know, as you totally believe and are probably right, you know, was anticipating the fish and excited to have this interaction with you, and it was a big social thing and totally fun for the dog and for you. But then you also have to be ready to say, huh, wait a second, that's not what he was doing. And then, you know, you have to be excited that, you know, maybe you were wrong and maybe there's another explanation. And that's the beauty of science, is it's not just about confirming your beliefs. It's about finding out what's true.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. That's true. You are listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Brian Hare from Duke University about dog cognition, and in particular, all of the research that led into his book, The Genius of Dogs, co-written with his wife, Vanessa Woods, also at Duke. We're talking about breed differentiation that kind of humans, I guess, took over from the wolves themselves once the wolves evolved to where they could get along with humans, and then humans began to turn them into the sometimes bizarre creatures that we have today as different breeds. But how long ago do you think that breed differentiation started?
Well, this is really fun to think about because it's always really surprising. And, you know, when I ask a crowd of people, how old are all the breeds that we're familiar with? You get a really wide variety of answers. But we know from genetic work now that all the breeds are about 200 years old. Most of the dogs that we are familiar with and, you know, we know so well, literally they did not exist 300 years ago.
Wow.
Now, dogs have existed at least 15,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a major change in dogs and our relationship with dogs around 200 years ago, where, you know, people didn't have iPads. People didn't have, you know, Gucci or fancy things to show off. And, you know, one of the things that they did have that was really what showed high status was if you could sort of create a new breed of pigeon or dog and, you know, you could demonstrate that it had some form or function that was different from others. And, you know, that was a, you know, gave you some level of status in your community. And so there was a huge cultural phenomenon that led to all these different breeds that now exist.
Interesting. You know, you're fairly new in this big area of research that to many people would be an obvious area of research, but for whatever reason has been shut down on for so long in science, and you're really exploring and opening it up. So all of our listeners, if you want to go to dognition.com, you can see the kind of citizen research, the crowdsourcing research that Dr. Hare and his colleagues are doing. You can also go to the Duke Canine Cognition Center at dukedogs.com, and certainly I urge you to buy the book, The Genius of Dogs, which is a great book, very interesting. You can buy it anywhere on Amazon and the usual outlets, and it's also out in paperback now. Thank you so much, Brian Hare, for being on with us on American Variety.
Well, this is really fun. Thank you so much, Court.
It was fun. I enjoyed it. Thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you enjoyed it out there, too. And I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.